In a world of Democrats,
there will be time for them to make profits. Now's not that time.
And Republicans,
I've abandoned free market principles to save the free market system.
You need a voice of liberty. Look no further. You found it. Tom Woods. Beware, citizen. You are now departing from the world of allowable opinion. The Tom Woods Show.
Welcome to the Tom Woods Show, episode 307. I bet you didn't know that today is the 100th anniversary of the Harrison Narcotics Act of 1914. But you do now, because you're listening to the Tom Woods Show for your daily serving of liberty education. And this one comes courtesy of our guest, Mark Thornton. Mark Thornton is a senior fellow of the Mises Institute, the author of several books, including The Economics of Prohibition, and he has an article out just today on the subject of this 100-year anniversary. You can get all that stuff linked over at the show notes page for this episode, which is tomwoods.com/307. Mark Thornton, welcome back to the show.
Hey, Tom. It's great to be back on your show. I've noticed you've been having a lot of great guests, a lot of important people. So I'm happy to be back on.
Well, I'm pleased to hear you say that. Thanks very much. In particular, of course, I had to have you on because the whole country naturally is commemorating the 100th anniversary of the passage of the Harrison Narcotics Act today. Well, maybe not. And if they are commemorating it, they should be in mourning because of what this set in motion. The drug war as we know it goes back to Richard Nixon, but it doesn't start there. It doesn't come out of nowhere. It has precursors. And in your article up at the Mises Institute today, we'll link to it in the show notes at tomwoods.com/307, you're talking about precisely one of these precursor events. Tell us about the Harrison Narcotics Act.
Well, Tom, it is a tragic anniversary, but the war on drugs was really born 100 years ago today when the U.S. Congress passed the Harrison Narcotics Act. And that set in motion a century of suffering here in the United States. Basically, the U.S. wanted to get into world diplomatic affairs, and so it organized the Opium Conference a few years prior to the Harrison Narcotics Act. It wanted to be a big player and thought that the opium trade would be a way of doing it and suppressing the opium trade. And then, of course, there was a lot of bigoted, racist hysteria going on in the United States in the progressive movement, and those forces all combined to the writing and passage of the Harrison Narcotics Act of 1914. And it started out innocently enough as a tax and register and regulate piece of legislation where Congress would require the Treasury Department to tax any opium products, require that opium be listed in ingredients of various products, and registration of prescribers and users and dealers in any kind of opiate or narcotic, as well as cocaine. However, that quickly devolved into more or less outright prohibition because the bureaucrats at the Treasury Department deemed it that basically doctors who prescribed narcotics and opium and cocaine to addicts, it was an illegal medical practice. So that for the first time, Treasury bureaucrats got into the business of determining what was proper medical practice. And so, you know, that just started establishing, you know, black markets in these products and people being arrested, doctors being intimidated, addiction treatment plants, facilities being shut down. And then, of course, that continues to spiral throughout the 20th century until we get to the declaration of an outright war by President Richard Nixon.
So you're saying that this is an example, as if we needed another one, of a piece of legislation that seems minor, seems hardly worth worrying about, but that can set in motion a series of events that culminate in something that, well, really nobody of good sense wants.
That's absolutely true. I mean, it seems public-spirited. It seems reasonable. and all of that. But of course, behind the scenes, there's some really ulterior motives here on the part of diplomats and politicians and racists and bigots that, you know, set forth the forces to bring out the legislation. And when you look at the legislation, it seems reasonable, you know, a small tax, you know, regulations, registration, all of that, you know, like gun registration. But, you know, it quickly got out of control, and it quickly set in motion some really nasty effects. And of course, every time the nasty effects reach the surface, the bureaucracy and the political forces only say, well, let's ratchet up the penalties. Let's, you know, get more police involved. Let's raise the jail terms, things of that nature. And of course, it's only a few years later that we get alcohol prohibition. And then in 1937, they did the same thing with marijuana, cannabis, which was used in a variety of products in the American economy, and hemp was used in a variety of products in the American economy. But some Mexicans were smoking weed, some jazz musicians were smoking weed, and so we had to suppress that. And initially, it was only a tax, the Marijuana Tax Act of 1937, but of course, it gets incorporated into prohibition and ultimately becomes a class one drug. In 1970, the Comprehensive Drug Control Act, a class one drug, so they said it's as dangerous as heroin, and which is, of course, preposterous. And not only that, but it also made hemp illegal. And hemp is just, you know, something you use to make paper or textiles or even oil or animal feed. It's also medicinal, and yet they prohibited it. So it's just outrageous pieces of legislation that no one really noticed at the time. But of course, today it's killing thousands and thousands of people. It's ruining thousands and thousands of families. It's incredibly expensive for the government, the taxpayers, and the economy as a whole, because we've got like a million people in prison that the American taxpayers, you know, supporting to the tune of over $50,000 a year. So it's just outrageous.
Mark, when you say that there are these vested interests, there are these interests that you wouldn't think of when you think about the drug war, the other side of that coin is that the drug war in its, we might call it its extremely early stages, the ones you're talking about in this article, was not motivated by the concerns of health professionals. That's what I think most people assume, that health professionals banded together and said it would be better for Americans if we banned or controlled or taxed these various products. And what you're saying is that that is not the case at all, that it was largely the types of prejudices that you're talking about, various sorts of hysteria. None of it was really founded in science at any reason, at any level.
That's right. I mean, it wasn't a call of the medical profession. It wasn't the call of the legal profession. It wasn't scientists who were up in arms about this. As a matter of fact, the American Medical Association, I know for a fact, I read the testimony during the hearings on the Marijuana Tax Act. The representative from the American Medical Association testified against this legislation and said, no, you should leave cannabis alone. You know, it's used to make horse liniment and, you know, a variety of proper medical uses. My father was a pharmacist, and we had a lot of antique pharmaceutical supplies, and there was these two big jars, and one was labeled cannabis indica, and the other was labeled cannabis sativa. So there were two variations on what we call marijuana today that were used in a variety of preparations, so that the pharmacist had to take that basic product and add things to it to make a variety of perfectly legitimate, you know, medical solutions for people and as well as animals. And so it wasn't scientific at all. It was all politics And it was all bigotry and racism, basically, that were driving these, and yellow journalism, of course, too. You know, they were saying things during marijuana legislation in the Harrison about, you know, Chinese immigrants, you know, doing devious things under the influence of opium, or African-American men being impervious to bullets and raping white women, and just outrageous claims in support of these really irrational, illogical pieces of legislation.
Well, one of the arguments they did make, though, apparently fairly early on, is an argument that we hear very regularly today when the subject turns to marijuana. When it turns to marijuana, people have to face the fact that this does not appear to be an especially dangerous drug, to put it mildly. I mean, sure, there are health effects, but it's not going to kill you instantly. It's not, you know, people aren't dying of overdoses of marijuana or any such thing as that. So you have to come up with some other rationale for prohibiting it. And these days, it's not fashionable to say, well, the Mexicans are getting all hopped up on it. So, you can't talk that way anymore. So you got to come up with some other explanation. And the explanation is that it's a gateway drug, that sure, you may start with something as relatively mild as marijuana, but eventually you're going to need a fix that's greater than that, that packs a greater punch. And before you know it, you're going to have a heroin needle hanging out your arm, and you're going to be living on the street. Like, that's the argument that we hear a lot today. And apparently it was being heard long ago as well. You have a response to that that is, in some ways, different from the typical response, because it's based on your own research that you did for your book, The Economics of Prohibition. What's your take on that gateway drug claim?
It's interesting, Tom. When I was at the Oxford Union debates,
I was going to ask you about that, too. Yeah. Let's talk about that. Yeah, go ahead.
I heard that exact argument by a British drug law enforcement bureaucrat. He said that if we allowed marijuana to be illegal, pretty soon the entire population, or nearly the entire population, would be addicted to heroin. So, I mean, that gateway theory is alive and well. They started out, in order to get the Marijuana Tax Act passed, you got to remember that hardly anybody smoked marijuana in the United States, or it wasn't really used at all for smoking purposes, for intoxication purposes. So what they were saying was that marijuana would kill you, number one, which of course it can't. Marijuana leads to insanity, which of course it doesn't. And that marijuana leads to violent activity and sexual abandonment, which of course it doesn't. And so at one hearing in Congress, some scientists got up and said, you know, none of those things are true. In fact, some of them, it's exactly the opposite. It doesn't make you violent. It makes you nonviolent. And so the drug czar of the time, Harry Anslinger, got up and on the spot invented the gateway theory. He said that, well, marijuana might not kill you, but it does cause people to eventually adopt harder drugs. And so if you smoke marijuana, eventually you'll be addicted to heroin. And of course, that theory has ultimately been proven to be incorrect in every aspect. There's no physiological reason why that would take place. And so scientists, medical people have researched this issue and found it to be completely untrue. My research, what I did when I was working on my dissertation and in the economics of prohibition, and I've written it, you know, several times, I've gotten a lot of mileage out of this, is that it's really that drug law enforcement itself, by creating a risk for smugglers and dealers, makes them want to have a smaller drug that's easier to conceal. And so the more drug enforcement there is, the more penalties, the longer the prison terms, the more these smugglers and dealers want a smaller, more compact product. And so as we went through time, as we went through the 70s, I looked at the data, and the more they spent on the drug war, the more potent marijuana became. And it was like, at the beginning of my study, it was like 0.5%. 12 years later, at the end of my study, it was over 4%. And today, it's close to 10%. So the drug war has done nothing but made drugs more potent and more dangerous. And of course, not only does that drug become more potent, but dealers and smugglers want to switch from big, bulky marijuana shipments to small, compact shipments of pure cocaine and pure heroin. And that's exactly what we've seen over time, is that marijuana has been largely displaced, and harder drugs such as cocaine, crack, methamphetamines, and heroin have come to dominate the marketplace.
Mark, I think the last time we had you were on the verge of appearing in those Oxford Union debates, and now it's taken place. So I'd like you to share with us a little bit of your impressions of that event and what kinds of arguments are being made against, or I beg your pardon, in favor of continuing the drug war in the year 2014. First of all, what exactly was the proposition that was being debated? And then secondly, what were the main arguments that your opponents were bringing up?
Well, the proposition was, should this House, when the House is the Oxford Union and the people in the Oxford Union, oppose the war on drugs? So my side was in the affirmative, that the members of the Oxford Union should oppose the war on drugs. And, you know, we had two teams, my team that was supporting that motion, and then there was another team that opposed that motion. And, you know, frankly, there were times when the audience started laughing at the other side arguments. And they had a journalist, a political leader on their side. They had a British top bureaucrat in drug law enforcement, and they had a specialist in drug treatment and drug addiction treatment, and as well as their student representative. And the drug treatment person, her only argument that drugs were bad. She even said that when she was young, that she was hooked on marijuana and drugs so much that she wanted to have a marijuana leaf tattooed on her hand, but the tattoo artist wouldn't do it because she wasn't 18. Well, of course, if a tattoo artist isn't willing to, in a legal setting, tattoo a minor, what makes you think, you know, Walmart and CVS and Walgreens are going to sell cocaine and heroin to minors? Well, they're not. So her argument was, you know, stupid. And, of course, we all agree that drugs can be dangerous. And then the British drug law enforcement bureaucrat, he's the one that said that if we allowed people to smoke marijuana, eventually most of the population would end up addicted to heroin, which is just the gateway theory. And then the journalist, politician, conservative politician, journalist, her argument that there was no such thing as the war on drugs, that we were basically letting people do whatever they want, which, of course, the audience got a good kick out of that as well. So the arguments really weren't there. And I thought our side did incredibly well in presenting the case against the war on drugs. And the audience seemed to be with us and seemed to be against us, Tom. But the interesting thing is that the back section of the Oxford Student Union, where they hold the debates, after our student got up and made the motion against the war on drugs, all the students in the back of the Oxford Union debate hall got up and they walked out the nadir. So the voting on the debate takes place by you walking out the nadir or the yay door. And as a result of all those students walking out the nadir, we actually lost the debate by one vote. So politics and ballot stuffing are alive and well at the Oxford Union. And, you know, of course, Oxford is the political hotbed of England and Great Britain. It's, you know, literature, drama, law, and politics. It's not Cambridge, where they concentrate on science and physics and astronomy and those sorts of things. It's the softer side of British academia. And it's where all of the politicians, the politicos of England come from. So, politics was alive and well even there.
Mark, I'm not sure if I'm imagining this or remembering it incorrectly, but is there some policy there that there are no recordings of these events?
No, that's another anomaly. Typically, they are recorded, audio, video, lots of pictures being taken. You know, I think that some of them have actually been shown on television over there.
Okay.
But for some reason or another, this particular debate, the only debate of the year where it wasn't recorded audio or video, the photographs, which they usually put up a couple hundred photographs of these events on their Facebook page, surprisingly, it took them about 5 months to put the photographs up, and they only put up 30. So you can go to the Facebook page of the Oxford Union and dial down to the War on Debate issue, and you'll see a few photographs. There's, I think, three or four of me, and they did capture my opening joke when I you know, I was told I needed a joke, and
this is a devastating joke. Let me warn people. Okay, this joke is not for any delicate flowers in the audience. All right, go ahead.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it was great. I mean, I got a humongous response to the joke in terms of the audience laughing. And I don't know if you want me to repeat it here.
Yeah, well, look, how could we build it up and then not deliver it, right? Yes,
well,
I do.
It's in the article on the Mises.org site, but I got up there, and I was the first real person to get up, you know, besides the student. And I said, "Mr. Chairman, I want to thank you for the opportunity to debate the war on drugs in this forum. And Mr. Chairman, as you probably know, the war on drugs was not a response to call from experts. It was not a response to recommendations from the medical community or even the law enforcement community. Mr. Chairman, the war on drugs was started by the agitation of racists, bigots, religious fanatics, believer in eugenics, extremist politicians, and power-hungry diplomats. In other words, Mr. Chairman, the average ordinary American."
Oh, that's killer, Mark. That's hard. That's hard even for me to hear. but certainly that is suited to get a rise out of that audience, and it succeeded, apparently. Well, I'm glad that you were there representing us as part of that. I wish we had that footage. It recalls an episode of my own that I think I'll relate to the folks once I let you run, but it's one of these things where you almost wonder if maybe they wanted the debate to turn out a different way, or they wanted it to, even though the voting went against you ever so slightly, I have a funny feeling the arguments were clearly in your favor. So this is all speculation, right? We can't know why they played down this debate.
Yeah, it's a real mystery. I must say it was a magical experience, you know, not just in Oxford, but in London and the people that I met and touring Oxford and seeing a city that is, you know, it's actually over 1,000 years old, but some of the schools within Oxford University are like 700 or 800 years old. And if it wasn't for the automobiles and the bicycles, you'd think you were in some kind of Harry Potter movie.
How about that? Well, listen, I'm going to let you go. I appreciate your helping us make note of this important anniversary today, even though it's not a happy one. I'm going to refer people to the show notes page so they can read your article easily. You can get there at tomwoods.com/307. You'll see Mark's article, links to Mark's work, stuff we've talked about, Mark's Twitter, where you can follow him, and you can get all kinds of, Mark links to interesting stuff all the time, so I strongly recommend following him there. And, of course, we'll link to the Mises Institute, which is my favorite organization in the world. Mark, thanks for your time today.
Thank you, Tom. But I am optimistic that we can defeat this war on drugs, and shows like yours really make a difference.
Thanks so much, Mark. All right, everybody, before I get you to my funny little story that I'm pretty sure you guys will like, let me remind you I have a new book out that I think you guys will really like. It covers all the sorts of topics that we like to talk about: war, foreign policy, conservatives and why they're terrible on foreign policy and how to persuade them to change their ways, the Federal Reserve, all the arguments you need when people corner you and say, "Well, the Fed has given us more stability. What's the matter with you, you ingrate?" All these things and more are in my new book, Real Dissent, A Libertarian Sets Fire to the Index Card of Allowable Opinion. Check that out at realdissent.com. And I read the audiobook. I'm the narrator of the audiobook version of Real Dissent. And you are entitled to one free audiobook, so you could just as well make it that one, via TomWoodsAudio.com. Get your free audiobook through TomWoodsAudio.com. All right, the story is this. Several years ago, I gave a talk at the business school at the University of Connecticut. It was part of a round table. I guess it was a triangular table, really. There was a moderator, and there were two speakers. We were all named Tom, all three of us, the moderator, the other speaker, and me. I don't want to mention names here, but the other speaker was the head of a major American insurance company. Actually, I'm pretty sure they're worldwide. And their headquarters were like right down the street from the University of Connecticut Business School. So obviously the business school had a very good relationship with this insurance company. No doubt there were internships, there were opportunities for their students, their graduates. So they had a very friendly relationship. Well, anyway, we were talking about the financial crisis. This was probably 2009 that we had this event. We're talking about the financial crisis. And this head of this insurance company was an awfully nice fellow. But he got up there and said, now look, you know, hey, I favor free markets, you know, and you know where that's going, right? I favor free markets, but in this case, we all know we need bailouts. And he went on and on, gave that argument. Very standard, very predictable. Fair enough. That's what I expected him to say. So then I got up and gave the anti-bailout argument, and I talked about the Austrian School of Economics. And I repeatedly made clear that, of course, the Austrian School has nothing to do with Austria per se. It's just the name of a school of thought. It's an intellectual tradition. The guy gets up to give his response to my remarks, and I am not joking with you. He said that, you know, he doesn't mean this personally, but he's going to have to criticize me. And I thought, uh-oh, well, maybe there's something I've overlooked, and I was a little nervous. And he said, but look, you know, Austria's GDP, I mean, look at what a tiny fraction it is of the American GDP. So what possible concern to us could be the economy of Austria, the economic condition of Austria? And I'm trying my best to stage whisper to him, it's just a school of thought. It has nothing to do with Austria. And the funny thing is there were students in there who were apparently, at least a few of them I found out later, really thought he had zinged me with that. Hello? He's made a complete fool of himself. And I got up there and I was as kind as I could be, but I said, that would be like me saying, we shouldn't listen to Milton Friedman because, hey, have you looked at the GDP of Chicago? I mean, it's pretty trivial compared to the GDP of the whole United States. I mean, talk about completely uncomprehending. I had just given a 30-minute overview of the Austrian school, and that was what I got. Well, that video, they made a video of it. There was recording equipment everywhere, and they were going to release it, and they never did. And I am absolutely convinced the reason they never did is that he looked, frankly, not that good after what he had just done, and they had no desire to destroy a perfectly fruitful relationship with a major insurance company by making the CEO look like a fool. I mean, it's certainly just the abstract principle that you should release video footage that you record was not enough to trump the more urgent principle of we want to maintain our relationship with this company. That's certainly my theory, and I think I have good reason for believing it. All right, everybody, make sure and check out the show notes page for today, TomWoods.com/307. While you're there, check out the supporting listeners Tom Woods bag of goodies. All the goodies I give you guys for supporting the show, including the Kindle edition of my new book, Real Dissent, but all kinds of stuff. The courses that I'm preparing for the Ron Paul Homeschool Program, all sorts of things are in there for you as a thank you for helping out the show. Check that out at TomWoods.com/307. And we'll see you tomorrow.
The Tom Woods Show.